end of life in prison. Hospice is needed there, just like anywhere else. That's according to Carol McAdoo of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, and she joins us now on the Bioethics Channel. The Bioethics Channel is a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org, practicalbioethics.org. Carol, the first U.S. prison hospice program began in Springfield, Missouri, in 1987, and since then, how do and have people reacted to the idea of hospice in prison?
For the most part, Laurel, people have been very eager to hear how it works. People in the free world or people out in the state are afraid it's going to cost them money. They're sometimes afraid we're going to coddle murderers and kidnappers and rapists. But people on the inside have watched inmates die alone and in pain for far too long. So when the program started in Springfield, Missouri, it was because they knew they could not continue to let people die the way they were dying. It was followed by 8 programs, just like that, one right after the other. The most stunning of those, I believe, would be at Angola. And that's a remarkable program that continues to grow. However, we are now at about 75 programs across the country, growing, but slowly. And it's based on people believing that there's a chance it could cost money. Actually, it saves money.
So the mindset, the idea of coddling prisoners, does that carry as much weight as it perhaps used to?
No, not as much as it used to. I think people are more sensitive because 1 in 100 Americans is in some way hooked into the judicial system. They're either on home arrest, or they're in parole, probation, they're in jail, they're in prison. 1 in 100, that's more than any other country in the world. So because of that, everybody knows somebody who's in prison.
That was going to be my next question. Family members and extended acquaintances.
That's right. And that's been the worst thing to happen, but the best thing to happen. Because the reason it is better is that people have an understanding of what it's like to have someone in prison.
So the idea is one thing, and now the numbers are starting to make themselves to make itself felt. The demographics for prisons and prisoners is just the same as it is for the rest of the country. We're an aging country, and there are aging individuals in prison.
There are multiple reasons for the increase in the aging population in prison. It used to be that if you were 55, the likelihood of a judge sentencing you to 10 years in prison was very slim. Now, if you're 55, you're going to get what anybody gets. If you were female, you were not likely to get sentenced to prison unless you had done something really awful. Now, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, everybody gets sentenced. Everybody's sent the same way. And then when you take the 3 strikes and you're out, which, you know, the non-negotiable sentences.
So the sentencing standards
make
a difference.
Huge. And so here we have all of these elderly people in prisons who are no longer dangerous.
Individuals in their 70s and 80s, right, where before they wouldn't have even reached that stage wouldn't have been sent there in the first place.
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, then there are also some physiological things at work here, too. And one statistic that I thought was kind of interesting to me was the idea that these are individuals who age more quickly for a lot of different reasons.
Right. Primary reason being they've usually led hard lives. Not everyone is Bernie Madoff. Not everybody has led the kind of privileged life of white-collar criminals. Most of the people who are in prison, about 85%, have some kind of drug convictions. That's tremendous. And so they're between the life that they have lived, the kind of care that they have not received. They haven't had yearly physicals like the rest of us and that kind of thing. So they simply, disease takes them over. Their recovery is much longer. And their likelihood of recovery from a serious disease is less likely to be effective and helpful.
So we have all these issues in place. We have the data that's driving it.
Right.
So then how do we go about incorporating a hospice program in prison? Mm-hmm. And I would imagine there will be some obstacles to that, wouldn't there?
Yes, there are obstacles. There are a lot of them. In the beginning, the major obstacle was to get around, get through to security officers to understand they were not breaking the rules by having special rules for those who are dying. There was a time when if you, well, let me use as an example, if there was a death anywhere in the prison, it was a crime scene, yellow tape, you know, the whole thing. And so in the beginning when there were baby hospice programs, any death was a crime scene. And so instead of having the hospice world be as you would hope it would be, comforting, kind, it was a crime scene. And so the bodies were shifted out the doors and away you would go.
Well, that certainly enters a different dynamic there.
But most of all, what is happening is that people understand that you can give opioids to patients who are incarcerated, and that doesn't mean anybody else is going to get them. You can use volunteers. There are over two-thirds of the programs, the 75 programs, that use inmate volunteers. We train them, and they are remarkable because they understand the situation. They understand what the dying inmates are facing.
So then other obstacles like the warden. I'm sure you'd have to have buy-in from the warden, would you not?
Yeah. The warden is afraid it's going to cost more money. Now, I will tell you that in the last 5 years, I have met more wardens who are saying, we have to do this here, you know, who are really advocates for the program. In fact, I was just in Jeff City not too long ago, and the warden there is the major push behind the programming. Same was true in Angola. The reason Angola got started and the Angola remains as a star in the hospice crown is that the warden won't have it any other way. I would say that in the beginning, security officers were probably the biggest obstacle because they couldn't see that you could have nurturing environments and secure environments. Now we're doing a lot of education. And so there are many more security officers who really understand that they can be kind and caring and still have a secure environment.
Well, paint a picture then of how it works, because whenever you have end of life, on the one side, you have the advance directive. You have someone designated to speak for you when you can no longer speak for yourself. And then the image of hospice, of being surrounded by loved ones and getting the pain relief that's required for you. Is it much different than in a prison environment?
You know, it would depend upon the prison. If there are 75 programs, they look 75 different ways. It all depends on how much the warden is really willing to release some of the rules and change them. But I think it's fair to say that people who work in the same prison for a long time have come to have a much greater sensitivity to these issues because they know the inmates. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in a prison in which the warden was attending the death of an inmate. And when the inmate died, he cried. Now, that inmate had been in his prison for 21 years. He had known him. Now, And so that's not something you expect. And that doesn't mean he was a soft warden who was unable to manage his business. People feel differently about death now, probably thanks to all of the work you've been doing here at the center.
I like to think that. Well, then how is it different then for someone who provides the services? Mm-hmm. What has your experience been in providing hospice services mm-hmm. to prisoners?
Mm-hmm. It feels miraculous because when you sit beside the bed of a dying inmate and you hold his or her hand, it is just like any death, anywhere, anytime, except this person is filled with anger, remorse, all to a huge extent because of either the crime they've committed or the crime they've been accused of that they do not feel they're guilty for. There's a tremendous emotion. And so one of the advantages of hospice care for inmates is that you hope to address all of those issues and have a time for reconciliation with the family. I think it's fair to say in about half of the crimes, somebody in the family has been a victim. So reconciliation is huge. And hospice does that. The social workers, the caseworkers, the counselors contact the family. Would you like to see your father? And so I've heard story. I've interviewed over 400 inmates and their family members and people involved in this. And again, I hear the most important thing. The most important thing is that I can have a chance to ask forgiveness. I may not get it, but I can ask.
So it's a different for the hospice provider then, being able to walk away from that for a prisoner than for someone, say, in a nursing home or something like that?
I think it depends on the healthcare professional. We do a lot of teaching of healthcare professionals. Some of them come in hard as stone.
Yeah.
And they're only there because it's the best job in town. Others are there because they have specifically requested to be in the hospice program. And I'll tell you a quick little story about a security officer I had interviewed. And I asked the people at the prison not to give me somebody who would just say, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. So he used several bad words when I said, what do you think of the program? And when I said, well, then this is a union shop, so you would have had to ask for this job, air conditioning.
Wow.
Well, that's not usual, but it's a funny story. And it is, it's just all the people who work in prisons are just like you and me. We just work with different, we don't have to watch our back in the same way.
75 prisons offer this.
Yes.
There are more than 75 prisons in the country.
Yes.
Easy enough
to
say.
Yes.
Then how is it where this can be a model? And you implied that there were 75 different ways of providing the hospice care in these 75 prisons.
Yes.
Is there a single model that's evolving that the rest of the prisons across the country or a good proportion of them might be able to emulate?
The prisons learn from each other. There's no doubt about that. There are mentoring programs. We've started a number of places where we can connect one prison who is getting a program going to others. But the biggest thing is, you know, while there are only 75 programs, they're usually in max or super max prisons because those are the people who are going to be there. Minimum prisons never have a hospice program. So the issue here that we need to deal with is to make sure that people who are at any of these levels actually not just have end-of-life care but have palliative care and then have chronic disease care. So it is just like in the free world. There is a need for a growing continuum.
So it's not as easy just to say a model for a particular prison.
It's a bigger issue. It is a way bigger issue. I'll give you an example. In Topeka, in the women's penitentiary, they have a death once every 2-3 years. But they have a program. And that is because they have trained volunteers, they have policies and procedures in place, and if they identify someone who is terminal, they gear up the program. Simple as that. So they are ready to go. There's a program in Iowa where it's, again, in a women's prison. They don't have very many deaths, probably, again, one in 3 years. But they have turned their hospice room, which is beautifully decorated, and they're trained volunteers, into workers who can stay with patients when they come home from surgery. So it's like a skilled nursing home.
Sure.
And they can just provide their care and their attention in that way. That way they keep their skills sharp. If somebody is dying, they're ready to go. People tell us again and again that being a hospice volunteer has changed their life. By the same token, people who are dying say they never expected to be cared for by someone who loves them.
So you have this presentation in late September, September 30th, in Jefferson City, Missouri, the Missouri End of Life Coalition Policy Summit. What kind of messages do you plan to deliver then?
I hope to deliver a message of hope. I hope to deliver a message of motivation. I hope to deliver a message of energy. And more than anything else, I want people to walk out of there saying, we are doing good work. And I want them to walk out saying, we can do more. That's it.
And that's enough, isn't it?
75 minutes.
Carol McAdoo is with the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. For more information on the Missouri End of Life Coalition Policy Summit, call 573-635-4999. That's 573-635-4999. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Champion.